Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Well, hello, everybody. It's the Vox Pop, and it's Medical Monday, October 24th. I'm Alan Chartok. Underwriting support for Medical Monday comes from ClipCentric Incorporated, ClipCentric Albany, a local video service division of ClipCentric, producing video advertisements for businesses throughout the capital region for web, mobile, and TV, ClipCentric.com. Joining us today is our great favorite, Dr. Paul Lemansky, a personal friend of mine and a guy who I really like, of Capital Care Center for Preventative Medicine in Albany. That's the Capital Care Center for Preventative Medicine in Albany. Dr. Lemansky is here to answer your questions. It's going to be a busy hour, so be sure to get your calls in early. They're already coming. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Hello again and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Dr. Paul Lemansky joins us today to respond to your questions and comments. Comes to us from the Capital Care Center for Preventive Medicine. That is the Capital Care Center for Preventive Medicine. Dr. Lemansky is a board-certified internist with a master's degree in human nutrition. He's a graduate of New York Medical College. Prior to his work at the Center for Preventive Medicine, Dr. Lemansky was clinical chief for cardiovascular health for Kaiser Permanente's Northeast Division. He's currently assistant clinical professor of medicine at Albany Medical College and a fellow of the American College of Physicians. Paul Lemansky, thanks so much for being here.
Absolutely.
You are as much a part of this radio station as anybody I know. And let me begin by asking you, we've already got some people on the line, but before we do, I want to, if I can, ask you about a couple of things, because you and I have
Sure.
been throwing this around a little bit.
Absolutely.
And that is that we do know that virtually every medicine has a downside to it. It has something that could hurt you. So let me go through a couple of them with you. Let's talk about statins for a minute.
Sure.
What are the downsides on statins?
Well, whenever one thinks about the risk-benefit of a given medication, one has to look at it within the context of why you're taking it. So, for example, someone who has established heart disease has more reason to be taking a statin than someone who just has elevated cholesterol. When you start looking at statins in general, the most common complaint that requires patients to discontinue the medication is either muscle aches and pains or muscle weakness. So myalgia, myopathy, and that could actually affect as many as 10% of patients who take statins. So it's a huge number of people. You know, there are things that one needs to know about the use of statins. As an example, that the side effect profile of a statin is increases in a linear fashion with the dose of the drug. So when one goes from 10 milligrams of a given statin to 20 milligrams of a given statin, the side effect profile of that medication doubles.
Wow.
Okay. The cholesterol-lowering capability, however, only goes up by about 6%.
So you better get, we should cut them in half.
Well, you know, I think the current guidelines suggest that one take a high dose, if can tolerate it, and drop to a moderate dose, which is usually half of a high dose, if can't tolerate it. And then if one can't tolerate the moderate dose, to go to any dose that could be tolerated. And again, that's probably most important for people with established heart disease or atherosclerosis, you know, the cholesterol plaques in the walls of the arteries.
So let's talk a little bit about proton pump inhibitors.
Sure.
When I started taking them 1,000 years ago, I was told, don't take them forever. That's easier said than done.
Well, it is. And the thing about, so proton pump inhibitors, basically the proton pump that we talk about is what's producing hydrogen ions or acid in the stomach. So it actually shuts off the production of acid in the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
And it can reduce it to almost zero.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is particularly good if you've got an ulcer or something that's related to excess acid. But sometimes, over time, you know, it becomes less of an important drug to take for people with ulcers. In other words, people whose ulcers heal can stop the medication. People who have an underlying chronic condition, which is treated by, like, gastroesophageal reflux disease, when acid comes up into the esophagus and irritates the esophagus, those individuals tend to be the ones who remain on the proton pump inhibitors long term. And the unfortunate thing is that there are, as you had mentioned, side effects to the use of proton pump inhibitors, some of which are serious and some of which are emerging as potentially serious issues. One would be, for example, calcium absorption is altered, magnesium absorption is altered. These can cause some problems.
Osteoporosis.
Can worsen osteoporosis, can cause arrhythmias if the magnesium goes too low. Infections. So as an example, when you drop the acid in the stomach, which normally fights off bacteria, there'll be bacteria in the bowel that may overgrow. Mm-hmm. And the ones that we're concerned about is something called Clostridia difficile, which is a may normally be found in the bowel, but overgrows in the presence of antibiotics, as an example. So you can have antibiotics kill off the good bacteria, and you get an overgrowth of this Clostridia difficile, and it can cause significant problems, put you in the hospital. You know, it's a not insignificant problem, could cause chronic diarrhea. But also, interestingly, Alan, lung infections can be increased, in part because the acid, low acid, allows organisms that wouldn't normally live in the upper esophagus and respiratory tree to become present, and those can cause increase in community-acquired pneumonias. Mm. So a lot of these things are significant with long-term use, and that's one of the reasons why we recommend that if you don't need to take it at high dose all the time, you know, or if you can take it at a lower dose, or even get off of it, and how one drops from high to moderate to low is in part related to the use of, for example, in a chronic condition like gastroesophageal reflux, is related to whether you can treat that gastroesophageal reflux in other ways. And by other ways, I mean with lifestyle change. So, you know, your doctor says to you, well, Alan, don't eat, you know,
I tried that.
At 8:30 at night and then go to bed at 10 or 9:30. That's not good because the stomach and the acid is still in your belly. You lie down flat and some of it can wash up into the esophagus.
Mm. Now, Paul Lemansky, you have recommended to patients, I know, that they take regular statins, but you also have prescribed something called Zetia. That's a different class of drug. What's that?
Yeah, that's a cholesterol transfer protein inhibitor. And what basically that is there's two ways that cholesterol gets into your bloodstream. The first way that it gets into your bloodstream is when you eat saturated fat and the fat goes to your liver and then your liver makes LDL cholesterol. The second way is when you eat dietary cholesterol. So in other words, you eat an animal-related product.
Yeah.
Cheese or something like that. Now, that may have saturated fat in it, but it also has dietary cholesterol. Eggs, example, have dietary cholesterol. So you eat these type of things, that can elevate. Zetia stops the dietary cholesterol from being absorbed as readily.
Hmm.
And therefore, it attacks, if you will, one of the pathways by which cholesterol gets into the bloodstream and elevates in the bloodstream.
Well, now I've heard that Zetia has, in some of the clinical tests, has done better than than some of the other stuff.
Actually, the studies have shown the best drugs for atherosclerosis are statins. There is evidence that Zetia, when combined with a statin, can reduce events in addition to reducing cholesterol. So we know that, and up till, you know, a couple years ago, we weren't aware of that. We knew it lowered cholesterol, but we didn't also know that it lowered heart attacks and strokes. Now we know that that's indeed the case. So Zetia is a good drug, but it, you know, not a substitute for a statin, at least in an individual who's at high risk, somebody who has, you know, has had a heart attack, has heart disease, has had a stent, those kind of things, who has plaques in their arteries that have been identified in some way.
Well, Paul Lemansky, I know we have two people hanging on already, but before we do that, I just want to go to a break a little early so we get more people in the first section of the program. So, Zach, take it away.
Comes from New York Oncology Hematology, now offering stereotactic radiosurgery in Saratoga County, SRS treatment for inoperable tumors. Available at their Clifton Park office, newyorkoncology.com. New England Hydroponics, the indoor gardening experts, offering a full selection of hydroponics, organic soils, and indoor gardening equipment. Southampton and Framingham, Massachusetts, online at nehydro.com. NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses, nbtbank.com. The Lathrop Communities, serving older adults in the Quaker tradition for over 25 years. Independent living in Northampton and Easthampton, Massachusetts, in the heart of the Pioneer Valley. Lathrop.kendall.org. And from Albany Cardiothoracic Surgeons, providing patient-centered heart surgery for over 40 years in the capital region, practicing cardiac surgery at St. Peter's Hospital, actsurg.com.
And we are back here with our favorite Dr. Paul Lemansky. We'll go to Bill in Gloversville. Bill in Gloversville, well, you're on.
Hello, doctor.
Hi, Bill.
I have heard that if you're over the age of 60, a half an hour, four times a week of swimming, bicycling, or walking is all that you need. Could you expound on that?
Sure. So generally what doctors have been saying recently, the experts in the area of exercise physiology have been saying you need about 150 hours, minutes, I'm sorry. Boy, 150 hours would be quite a bit. 150 minutes a week. So 30 minutes four or five times a week in order to get sufficient exercise to lower cardiovascular risk, to reduce blood pressure, to maintain and control body weight. So it serves multiple purposes. If you do too little, so let's say you do it once a week, you don't seem to get as much of the benefit. If you do too much, let's say you decide you're not going to just walk briskly, you know, 4 to 5 days a week, but you wanted to run, you may get some benefit, but that additional benefit, but that benefit is not as significant as you might think and comes with the cost of increased risk for injury. So when we're looking at the population as a whole and we're looking at individuals like in the United States who don't regularly exercise, we say, you know, to walk, if you have no arthritis in your knees, your ankles, your hips, to walk is a good way to start. You start with maybe 5 minutes a day and move up by 5 minutes a day per week. So the first week you do 5 minutes a day of walking, the next week you do 10 and so forth until you're walking about 30 minutes a day. Additionally, it also is not absolutely necessary that those be contiguous minutes of exercise. So for example, you could do 15 minutes in the morning and then you could do 15 minutes in the evening. And generally speaking, that's easier for a lot of people to do, to cut 15 minutes out of their schedule twice a day as opposed to a full 30 minutes once a day.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. You know, Paul, I do an hour, as you probably know, an hour every day on my bicycle, my Schwinn Aerodyne. Is that too much?
No, not for you.
Thank you. And is there such a thing as doing too much and then becoming immunized from, your body expects it. And if you don't do it, you're in trouble?
Well, there's certainly such a thing as doing too much, okay? And that's going to depend, again, on what your underlying medical issues might be. So somebody who has, you know, again, heart disease may not want to go out running, as an example. Walking tends to be much safer. But there certainly is too much. What you try to do is to get regular exercise. Now, you say, for example, that you do an hour a day. That's fine. Okay, you tolerate it well. It has benefit for you. And you've worked up to it over a number of years, and you've done it for a number of years.
Yes.
It's a different issue if you haven't done anything, and then you decide you're going to go out and do an hour on
this Schwinn
Airdyne. It would be a mistake to do that. Yeah. Most individuals over the age of 45 should speak to their physician before taking on an exercise program or a new exercise program so that they can get something called a stress test, which will take them up to a heart rate equivalent to what they'll be experiencing, and that makes it the most safe way to proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Paul, for that. We'll go to Jim in Matamoros. All right. Jim in Matamoros, you're on. Go ahead.
I could just speak a little bit about ARVD.
I'm sorry?
Say again,
Jim. ARVD is supposed to be a rare genetic heart disease.
Well, you've stumped the band, Jim. Call again next week, okay? Thank you. Thank you. Jim calls every week, usually the first guy to call, sometimes the second guy to call. Some days I think he's looking this stuff up in the, you know, obscure medical dictionary.
That can be, you know, acronyms are difficult to deal with. But.
Right. So there you go. And now we're going to go to Marta in Pottown, Poughkeepsie. All right, Marta, you're on.
Thanks, Dr. Shartok, for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask the doctor about when you were talking about, like, the proton inhibitors, the Prilosec. At one point, my mother, who has Parkinson, and I were at the neurologist, and she was looking at all the different things my mother was taking. And OxyContin was on the list, and I said, I thought she got off of that, which is another long story. And the doctor said, well, it's in Prilosec.
OxyContin?
And I've asked for confirmation of that. Can
no.
you tell me?
No, there's no OxyContin in Prilosec.
So the neurologist was mistaken.
Yeah, either that or they were communicating to you in a way that was confusing.
Yeah, because then I thought maybe that's why people have to have it like that. But the... I don't know. The other thing that impacted with the acid reflux seemed to be the microwaves coming off of a smart meter that was right on the other side of her wall. So I just thought I'd mention that. And when I put aluminum foil behind a photograph she had hanging there, that went away for me. And I only had it when I was visiting her. But when I heard Prilosec and might have an opioid in it, I was like, oh, boy. But this new information is pretty scary. My dad's been on proton inhibitors and his wife for years. Thank you.
Sure thing. Yep.
All right, that was Marta. And let's go to, oh, by the way, you have a very good chance of getting in right now. Very good chance. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to John in Albany. All right, John in Albany, you're on.
Thank you, Alan.
Sure.
I had seen on CBS News Sunday morning a segment about gene therapy, and I first of all had two questions. One is how does this work? How do you fix genes? I mean, if you could explain it in sort of layman's terms, and what kinds of diseases are they looking at fixing or curing?
Well, you know, most of the time they're talking about looking at some inborn errors of metabolism. You know, something you're born with that's a genetic abnormality. And, you know, I really don't know very much about it because there's very little of it going on currently in normal practice. You know, some of the ways that it's suggested to do is to use certain types of viruses that have been inactivated, but viral coats to get the genes into cells. But, you know, it's kind of a difficult thing to accomplish, and it requires a lot of molecular biology, and I really do not feel competent to answer questions on that, unfortunately.
But, Paul, is it where we're going? I mean, down the road, forget about the specifics of how to do it.
So to get to, you know, what I think, gene therapy is identifying, genetic abnormalities in an individual and then attempting to make some change in the genetic structure. I think before that happens, Alan, and a lot more what we're going to be using is, as we currently see, using genomics to determine, that is, trying to identify differences in the genetics of, say, tumor cells so that we can target specific treatments for those tumor cells. I would go so far as to say we will be able at some point in time to identify those individuals who respond to a certain drug so that we won't have to have empiric treatment of try this one, that didn't work, try that one, that didn't work, try that one. We'll know beforehand which drugs will work. Likewise, which changes, for example, lifestyle change will work. So, for example, you know that somebody can become a vegan and their cholesterol not drop that much.
Mm.
And you say, well, why would that be? Well, you know, they genetically have some predisposition to making...
How about dying? what I mean by that is, look, you take a look at Pete Seeger, right? He lived to 95, 96, something like that. His father lived that long. His brother lived that long. My father died before I am here what I am now, right, if you get it. So therefore, will we be able to find out what gene deficiency or supplement makes somebody live longer?
Well, I think probably, I mean, ultimately, I think, yes, there will be a way to address aging through genetic manipulation. Okay. That said, I think, you're opening up a can of worms.
Yeah.
I think that before that happens, certainly we'll be using genetic testing to identify who has a given problem such that we can make changes. Like, for example, who is going to develop heart disease? You know, a third of all people have a heart attack out of the blue and drop dead. How can we identify that heart attack waiting to happen? This is the kind of thing that I think gene therapy is going to be useful for. We'll be able to identify risk in individuals and do something about it.
Yeah,
they'll be able to do something about it before they have a bad outcome.
But of course, we already have an overpopulation issue in this world, and one can expect when this hits big time, it'll get worse.
That would happen.
Okay, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. All right. So now we'll go to, waiting for 2 minutes and 35 seconds, is Margaret in Albany. Margaret, you're on.
Hi, I'm calling regarding my father, who he's 67. He has a significant history of heart disease and diabetes. He had his first heart attack at 43. He's had double bypass and the whole nine yards. He's on a whole host of medications that I really can't even begin to tell you what they are. I know there's 30 some odd medications, but what I'm really calling for is lately he has been mentioning to me that he's having problems remembering things. It doesn't seem to be affecting his ability to take care of himself or his safety, but that he just mentions things that happened yesterday he just can't remember. And it's not in a funny way, like, haha, I can't remember. It's that he's just forgetting things. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to find out if it could be a mix of his medications, which I don't have the list of right now, or maybe some side effect of the heart disease, because we actually do have the gene in our family that makes you create the cholesterol and gives you quite a high cholesterol number, is why his doctor always said don't become
a
vegetarian.
Has he ever had a stroke that you were aware of?
Yes, he goes. He's a veteran, so he goes to the VA and they monitor his vision every year. And 1 year, they noticed kind of a blurry spot on his, I don't know, those CAT scans that they gave him or whatever. Then the next year, he mentioned he had a cold and all of a sudden couldn't smell anything, and the smell never came back. And mm-hmm. I said, well, Dad, you know, I think that you need to go find out because that's not normal. And come to find out, he had a second episode.
Mm-hmm.
So he does have a history, but that that last episode, I have to say, was probably about 8 to 9 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know of any other
episodes
since then, but that is my concern. I've heard of those mini strokes.
Okay,
sure. Well, you know, I mean, there's a lot to address here. So, first of all, knowing that he has atherosclerosis, he can have something called multi-infarct dementia. So if he has multiple small strokes, that can lead to dementia. There are reversible causes of dementia. So, for example, a low level of B12, hypothyroidism, something called normal pressure hydrocephalus, where there's a different pressure within the ventricular system of the brain. That's a area of the brain that is filled with fluid. There are different types of diagnoses that could go along with early dementia. The first thing I think you should do is to send him to have him seen by a neurologist to determine whether this is dementia or not. So, for example, dementia typically involves recent memory, you know, minutes to hours. You'll forget where you put something. I think one of the famous commercials on television now shows a person with early dementia leaving their car keys in the refrigerator and not knowing where they placed them. Placing things in inappropriate spots and then, you know, not being able to remember it. Every one of us has, as we get older, problems with forgetting names, forgetting what we just did. You know, I came into this room. Why did I come in here? Everybody has that. Everybody has problems word searching. They're looking for the proper word and they can't remember it. They're looking for the proper name and they can't remember it. These things are not necessarily related to dementia. However, a neurologist would be able to determine if indeed the symptoms your dad was having are consistent with dementia, and then would be able to look at possible causes, again, like I spoke of the reversible causes. So there are some causes that you can actually fix. There are some medications, that can certainly cause confusion, if not necessarily dementia. There are some medications that could cause, you know, changes in thyroid function that could indeed lead to dementia that is reversible once that medicine is stopped and the thyroid is normalized through medication or treatment. So, it's a complex problem. It needs more information, and that information is best, I think, gathered by a neurologist.
Okay, sorry we can't give you more time, but that's the best we can do. Thank you. Okay, now we're going to go to Darren in Fort Plain. All right, and Darren is on line number 3. Okay, Darren, you're on.
Okay, thank you all for taking my call today. Love Bob Pop, love WAMT. Glad I was able to contribute this year.
Great.
About celiac disease, wondering what the vital nutrient is that one lacks in a gluten-free diet, and how does one compensate for missing out that nutrient?
That's a great question. Here we go.
Well, in celiac disease, it's also called gluten enteropathy. And basically what happens is that you develop an immune response to gluten. So if you're an individual with this immune response, you eat gluten and it causes an inflammation in the small intestines, an inflammation in the small finger-like projections that go into the that are in the bowel that absorb food. It causes them to get swollen, and therefore you start not to absorb other nutrients. So it may cause some diarrhea, it may cause some GI complaints, but ultimately it can cause malabsorption to occur. And malabsorption can lead to a whole host of other problems. So what that diagnosis of, a lot of folks these days think to go on a gluten-free diet for all sorts of reasons. It's not necessarily the thing to do unless you have a diagnosis of gluten enteropathy. That can be obtained by speaking with your physician who can do at least an initial screening blood test. And then if that blood test is suggestive, they could place you on a gluten-free diet to see if your symptoms improve. The next thing to do, and the gold standard, of course, is to get a piece of the small intestine, those finger-like projections, and look at it under the microscope. And it's very characteristic for a gluten enteropathy. If that is diagnosed, a gluten-free diet can really dramatically improve symptoms and can normalize the absorption of nutrients.
And is that for the rest of your life?
Yes.
So that's pretty interesting. Yes. Okay, thanks for the call.
And is it something that's mortifying? Is it something that could cause death?
I'm sorry?
Yeah, we couldn't get you. Go ahead.
Is it something that could cause death if you don't follow that gluten-free diet?
Is it something that
it
could...
Potentially, it potentially could...
Fatal.
It potentially could if it caused the malabsorption of certain nutrients. However, you know, that's highly unlikely to occur. More often than not, you know, it's a misdiagnosis because people don't think of it. And so it more often than not results in sickness rather than necessarily leading to death.
Thank you. All right. We got an email saying, if a person does not have any history like a heart attack or plaque, how high a cholesterol level is acceptable before a statin should be taken, given the negative side effects like weakened muscles?
Well, of course, that's the $20,000 question.
Yeah.
Again, you know, this gets to, you know, this is the most difficult question that doctors have to answer is how high should the cholesterol go? The typical guidelines currently in place would say if your LDL cholesterol, the bad cholesterol, goes over 190, you need to be placed on a statin. However, let's assume you don't have any established plaque. You haven't had a heart attack. You haven't had a stent. No one's told you have any sort of a heart problem. And your father had a heart attack at 45. Okay. Now, I would say under those circumstances, you need to be evaluated very, very carefully because you indeed could have plaque and not know it. And a family history of premature heart disease that's powerful, and especially if you say you got a father and then you got a brother who had a heart attack or needed a bypass or a stent, those individuals generally should be on a statin as well, unless it's proven to be unnecessary otherwise. Now, one of the tests that you can get in a person who has no symptom is something called a coronary artery calcium score. It's a CAT scan of your heart looking for calcification. Well, why would we be looking for calcification? Because plaque, when it's in your heart for a while, begins to calcify. And we can actually measure the amount of plaque, get an idea of the amount of plaque that you have from the amount of calcium that's in the walls of the arteries of the heart. It's a very sensitive test, a very good test. And if your calcium score is extremely elevated, even if you have no symptom, you should be on a statin to prevent that heart attack waiting to happen.
Okay. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. We have to go for a minute in order to meet our obligations, but we'll be right back.
Support comes from Bodywork Professionals, licensed massage therapists, Nick Pavaldi, advanced structural integration practitioner, proprietor, offices in Latham and Saratoga Springs, open 7 days, your massage and bodywork experts, bodyworkprofessionals.com. Curtis Lumber announcing their new kitchen showrooms featuring kitchen design trends and cabinets from Wellborn and Merillat and quartz countertops from Cambria, curtislumber.com. Boyden and Perrin Amherst, Massachusetts, offering lawn and garden equipment parts and service to customers throughout Western Massachusetts, a family-owned business for over 50 years. BoydenandPerrin.com. The Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences in the Capital District and beyond. Skidmore.edu/Tang. And from George Heigl, Cowan's representative, accepting consignments of jewelry, fine art, historic firearms, American Indian art, historic items, and more. 518-396-7974.
And we are back with Dr. Paul Lemansky. A favor, please. The lines are all loaded. So what I want you to do is I want you to try to be as brief as you can with your question, and we'll get Dr. Lemansky to answer it. Okay? Is that all right with everybody? All right, good. If it isn't, well, noogies. Okay, we'll go to... We'll go to Bernie on line number 7. Bernie, you're on.
Hello.
Hello, Bernie, you're on.
Hello, Dr. Lemansky.
Hello.
I was diagnosed with atrial fibrillation about 3 years ago and have been using Eliquis since. And I have cut down on caffeine by drinking only decaf. Now, it seems I've been having very few episodes for the last, I don't know, 3 months, 4 months. And I'm wondering, is caffeine considered a trigger at this time?
So you're not in chronic, that is, atrial fibrillation all the time. You go in and out of atrial fibrillation.
Yeah, if I get it, it's for either a few hours, or if I go to sleep with it, it's gone in the morning.
Sure.
It rarely lasts more than maybe once in the blue moon, it was a whole day.
Yeah. I think certainly, you know, we all experience, if we drink caffeine, we can all experience some palpitations, some increased nervousness from the caffeine. And I think that could, in an individual so predisposed, could certainly lead to atrial fibrillation, episodes of atrial fibrillation. You know, that said, I think, you know, of course, the easiest thing for you to do is to try it. So, you know, if you start drinking coffee on a regular basis and you notice you've gotten a lot of, see, you have the benefit of having the experience of atrial fibrillation. You know when you're in it. Some people don't.
Uh-huh.
So if you can experience it, if you drink some more coffee and see that it's causing that, then I wouldn't drink the coffee. I mean, why? Even though you're on the Eliquis, which prevents blood clots from forming in your heart when it is in atrial fibrillation, and subsequently when it goes back into normal rhythm, those blood clots can break off and fly up into the circulation, can go to your brain or go to any other part of your body. You know, you need to minimize the episodes of atrial fibrillation, because the heart really doesn't work optimally in that rhythm. So you lose about 10% of the pumping capacity of the heart when you're in atrial fibrillation as opposed to when you're in normal rhythm. So, you know, I mean, what's that 10% going to mean? Well, if you're completely sedentary, it may not mean a lot. But if you want to do things, it may mean that, you know, you have less oomph to be able to do the things that you want to do.
Okay, Bernie, thank you. All right, now we're going to go to, let's see here, Eileen. All right, Eileen, go ahead.
Hello, Mr. Shartok and
Hi.
Dr. Lemansky. I'm just going to clarify, a previous caller asked about ARVD or ARVC.
Yeah, you know,
and you were saying that sometimes initials, whatever.
Yeah.
But that's arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy or dysplasia. And it's supposedly a genetic disease, but I was diagnosed out of the blue moon a year ago, so I just thought I'd bring some attention to it, that it does exist and there might be some interest listening.
And so you have. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, and let's see here. Now, the next person we want on here is going to be Ryan on line number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It could be 6, yeah. Ryan, no, 6. Okay, Ryan, you're on.
Hello.
Hello, Ryan, go ahead.
All right, so I'm in my early 30s. Oh, first, hello, doctors. Doctor told me I had high cholesterol. I got 162 LDL. My triglycerides are like 230-something. He's telling me I need to take statins. And I had a calcium scoring test, which came back negative. And I've done a stress test. The heart's good. I just wanted to get a second opinion on that, because separate things like the muscle aches and, you know,
sure,
liver problems from it.
Well, let me just preface what I'm going to say by saying that a radio program is probably not the best place to get a second opinion. You really should have some face-to-face, encounter with somebody, a cardiologist, for example, who might want to opine on this when they see all of the issues related to you. However, with a zero calcium score, that's excellent. So that means you have no measurable plaque. Now, that doesn't mean you have no plaque. That means we can't measure it. You may have plaque that hasn't calcified yet. So we still like to keep the cholesterol under 190 if we can. You said yours was 157?
My LDL is 165 or so, 162.
Is that on medication or off medication?
Off medication.
Okay. So that's reasonably good, actually. And, you know, would it be necessary to take a statin? Well, you know, one of the things would be family history, again, to look at. If you had a family history of premature heart disease, even with a zero calcium score, you might want to have it in a lower range as opposed to an upper range.
Are there any long-term effects on the liver?
Of statins? Absolutely. But not everybody who takes a statin is going to have any of the side effects of a statin. Those side effects are described in population of people. Not any one person is going to have all side effects. Likewise, all right. You know, let's say that, you know, you had seen a cardiologist and they said, well, just you have no real measurable plaque. We think you're at low risk, but still we think you should be on a statin. The next question to ask that physician who's familiar with all your information is, what about if I got my LDL cholesterol down without a statin? Would that be sufficient to satisfy your concern? And
I said that, and they mentioned that 85% of your cholesterol is made by your body, and that diet intake doesn't really have that much of an effect on it. That's, I'm kind of like
that's
belief of that.
Yeah, that's not rigorously true. So okay. If you look at, you could drop your LDL cholesterol as high as 20 or 30 points with a diet. And I'm talking about a reasonable diet. You could certainly drop it 30 points if you went on a low-fat vegan diet. Okay, that in the average person would drop quite substantially. You know, when we're talking 30 points, you're talking about what the types of LDL lowering that you'll see with a statin. That said, a lot of doctors feel that the statin is a better way to go because there's so few people that have been studied with diet alone that they have not been able to do the comparison between, all right, let's drop your LDL to such and such a level or by such and such a percent with a statin. Let's do the same thing with a diet, both groups having started off at the same, and see what's the effect. You know, we don't know that as rigorously as we'd like. And while we may have some idea of what the percent and of LDL reduction would be, we don't really have a good handle on what the effect would be on cholesterol plaque and on events, heart attacks and strokes. Statin drugs have 100,000 people randomized to clinical trials, so we have a very good understanding of how they reduce the risk for heart attack and stroke. What has to be done is a risk-benefit assessment. So we're not saying put everybody on a statin. We're saying those individuals who appear to have increased risk should consider this drug, certainly in conjunction with diet. We never want to do drug and not do diet. All right. If we're talking about lowering cholesterol, the two go together. But, you know, someone would have to be fairly intimate with your medical history and your cardiovascular history to be able to say to you, I think it would be reasonable to just use diet, or I think it would be preferential to use a drug. From what you've described so far, with a zero calcium score and no family history of premature heart disease, is my understanding, I would say that you could certainly see what diet could accomplish and then bring that information to your clinician and see whether they're satisfied with that.
Thank you, Ryan. Okay, now we'll go to Christina. All right. Joe Mackowitz is telling me exactly who to call on here. Okay, Christina.
Okay, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I was very glad to hear you were discussing statins when I turned the radio on and quite surprised that more was not said. I know that in some countries, a doctor will not prescribe a statin unless he also prescribes the supplement CoQ10, and that helps with the muscle problems. My husband did that, and the muscle problems went away. Mm-hmm. I was startled that you didn't mention another very serious side effect that I'm aware of. There seems to be a growing body of literature, small but growing, by some neurologists. Some call statins the mind robber. And I know personally people who have been on statins for a long time, have had serious medical problems, have cut back or stop taking statins, and their memories come back.
Well, I think certainly we've all heard stories like that as clinicians. And I think we need to pay attention to those stories. That said, I want you to appreciate that when physicians put patients on statins, they don't know beforehand that they're going to have some side effect from it. Not everybody has a side effect from being placed on a statin. 90% of people have no side effect whatsoever. Okay. So, number one, we don't know that beforehand what's going to happen. We have to try it. Number two, we always have to adjust risk and benefit. So if somebody said to you, look, you have heart disease and this drug could reduce, has a very high probability of reducing the likelihood of your having a heart attack or stroke, you also have to say, yes, there's a small risk of one of these other problems associated with statins. There's no safe, 100% safe drug. But does the risk to you and of taking the drug, is that a benefit for you when one looks globally at what risk and benefit is for you? So I agree with you completely. These things have to be looked at, have to be watched for, but we have to also balance it against the benefit that's proven that these drugs can bring in individuals.
Thank you. Okay, let's go. We're really running out of time here to Daniel. Daniel, you're on.
Thank you. I have a question, keeping in the same vein as the last few questions, about the relationship between muscle soreness and the use of statins. Mm-hmm. The reason I ask this is that for a number of years, quite a few, having been on statins, I would get very severe and very painful cramps in my my thighs, both front and back, and gradually in more recent years, it'll be accompanied by cramps in the hands, cramps in the feet, which are painful. And so I've decided to self-medicate. And I could never get an answer, even from my cardiologist, about the muscle soreness possible side effect. So I've self-medicated. I've cut back. I was on Crestor for a while, daily. I've cut it back to 3 times a week. And I think that there has been, again, a sample of one is infinitely unreliable, but I've had to self-medicate that way. And these are board-certified physicians who are prescribing.
Daniel, we're going to have to stop there because we're really running out of time. Hold on a second,
Paul. So I think that's an important point this gentleman raises. But I would say one thing, sir. If you're going to self-medicate, make sure that your clinicians know you're doing it, okay?
The other thing I would suggest
to you is not all statins could be taken 3 times a week. Some can, some can't. Certainly we shoot for taking medication like a statin. One lady beforehand talked about coenzyme Q10. That works sometimes. Again, most of it's anecdotal. That is, we have no clinical trials that really prove it works. Do I think it's worth doing? Absolutely. If it allows you, if you have are at risk for heart disease and it allows you to stay on a medication, I think that's a big plus. The second thing that I want to reemphasize what I said earlier is lower doses of statins, even when taken on a daily basis, can still give you benefit, okay? If you cut the dose of a statin in half, your LDL is going to go up by about 6 points, 6% or so. Now, that has to be done with the okay of your cardiologist, your primary care physician. However, the side effects profile of the drug is halved by using half the dose of the statin. So for those, and I'm only arguing this for some people who can't tolerate, say, 40 milligrams of a statin, rather than give it up completely, they may be able to tolerate 20 milligrams of a statin. And that should be tried before one says, I can't tolerate statins. Likewise, I have patients who have tried 5 or 6 statins before, finding the 6th one that works, or 4 statins before trying the 5th one that works.
That happened to me.
Me too.
So,
yeah.
So again, one shouldn't conclude from even 2 or 3 tries with a drug that they can't tolerate it.
Okay, got to let you go. All right, now we're going to go. We got to line number 8 here, and that is Monica in Pittsfield. Go ahead.
Monica?
Yes, Monica.
Yes, so I just have bursitis in both hips for a long time, and I suspect it's due to inflammation in the body, and I've tried PT and nothing really helps. Just started doing the anti-inflammatory diet, and just wondering if there's any other suggestions you had, if it's easy to test for it, if there's anything else I could do.
Who told you it was bursitis in your hips?
My primary care doctor.
I don't think
they didn't test it.
Did they examine you to come to that conclusion?
Yes, and I've had, you know, cortisone shots in both hips.
Okay, so there is something called trochanteric bursitis.
And okay.
Trochanteric, there's a small bursa, and a bursa is basically a fluid-filled sac that sits between the tendons and the bone, so that it kind of like, if you think about a baggie with some oil in it, it will make the movement of one over the other more easy to happen and less painful. When inflammation occurs, that can of course cause pain. So an anti-inflammatory diet does not work as well for a specific area of increased inflammation as much as treatment of that specific area, like as you had done with an injection of some steroid.
Okay.
I'm so sorry. We're out of time. I do apologize. And I apologize to Ben and Chris and Vivian and Carolyn and Kate Walter, all of whom were left on the line. We appreciate your calls very much and hope that you get in the next time. As I say, we're out of time. And thank you to everybody. And thank you, Paul Lemansky, for joining us today. Underwriting support for Medical Monday comes from Nathan Letower Hospital, announcing the building of a new dialysis center in Gloversville for renal kidney care. Open this winter, NLH.org. All right. Thanks again for everybody joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Joe Makowitz. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Shartok. And now we have a second. Paul, how do people get in touch with you?
They could call my office, 518-640-3260. And Alan, I just want to say that people with Barrett's esophagus should always talk to their physician before decreasing their proton pump inhibitor.
You are so right about that. Stay tuned now, everybody, for a news update.